From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on July 1st when the new president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School took office. Reverend Angela Sims became the school's 13th president, taking the reins from Reverend Dr. Marvin McMickle, who recently retired. Dr. Sims is the first female president in Colgate's 200-year history. She is the first African-American woman to lead a Rochester-area college. Sims comes to Rochester from St. Paul School of Theology in Kansas and Oklahoma, where she served as a professor and as vice president of institutional advancement. Her scholarly research centers on the intersection of faith, race, and violence. And we'll talk to her this hour about the cultural implications of lynching. It's the focus of her books, Lynched, The Power of Memory in a Culture of Terror, and The Ethical Complications of Lynching. Sims says we can apply lessons learned about lynching culture to the current social and political climate. Sims is also a Baptist minister and self-identified womanist. She says she's eager to lead Colgate into the future with the goals of building on its commitment to social justice and strengthening its connection to the community at large. It's fitting that one of her first roles as president was to officially relocate the college from its former home near Highland Park to its new location in the Village Gate in Rochester. We have a lot to talk about this hour. It's my honor to welcome Dr. Angela Sims, the new president of Colgate to Connections. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
I asked you briefly before the program began how you like being in Rochester, and you said so far you feel like it's a gem in this region.
I do. Rochester has, for those of us who are athletic enthusiasts, multiple walking trails. You've got wonderful waterways in this area. Your wineries and vineyards rival that of the Napa Valley. Culturally, the arts, the museums, theater, music, the diversity of whatever one would want to do is right here in this little community.
We're certainly going to talk about the mission of your work, about poverty in Rochester, mm-hmm. about how you view Colgate's role. But first, let's talk a little bit more about your background and tell our listeners where you grew up.
I grew up, let me caveat it this way.
Sure.
I grew up in a small village in a northeastern parish in Louisiana. I knew I lived in rural America, but I spent my summers in New Jersey with my cousins and relocated to the San Francisco Bay Area for high school. But it was not until I went back to Louisiana in 2009-2010 to do research that I realized how deep my rural roots are, and having to come to terms with what that means, particularly as it relates to my own identity as a social ethicist, as it relates to the research that I do. But recognizing that in some ways, my time in Louisiana has really prepared me for now. My parents were public school educators. My godparents were public school educators. And I grew up in a time when Louisiana public school systems were segregated. Relocated to California the year that the courts finally said Louisiana schools must desegregate. And I intentionally used the word desegregate and not integrate. My mother's experience teaching 20 years in Louisiana and 20 years in California really began to bring my attention to the ways in which communities remained segregated, even on the West Coast. I began my college education in Louisiana at Tulane University and finished at a Catholic girls' school in D.C. And I have traipsed all over the U.S. since then. But those experiences, the differences and the similarities between Louisiana and California have helped to shape who I am.
What's the earliest age that you were sort of cognizant or aware of racism?
Probably, I guess, maybe 4 or 5. I spent a lot of time with my maternal grandmother, and I recall her saying once when her quote-unquote insurance agent came by to collect her premium, and she had harsh words to say about him and his involvement with the Ku Klux Klan. So that would have probably been my earliest recognition. And then certainly going with her to the bank or to stores in that small town, and seeing the signs that were everywhere, colored enter here, whites enter here, but also recognizing the ways in which the neighborhoods were always desegregated. So living with the reality of a segregated culture, when your residential neighborhoods, you could have three blacks, two whites, were all interspersed, but there was something about that culture that allowed that racism to permeate.
You say you intentionally chose the term desegregate, not integrate. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because for me, integration means you take the best of multiple systems and you look for synthesis. What I experienced with a desegregation process, particularly in public schools, is that quality black public school educators, many of whom had master's degrees, were removed from previously predominant black-only schools and placed in previous all-white schools. And white educators, the majority of whom had what were called normal degrees or associate degrees, were sent into previously all-black schools without any cultural or historical training. And for me, that became what I would call the beginning of intellectual genocide within black communities. So if integration was going to be a process, it would have meant actually thinking about the ways in which resources would have been allocated more appropriately and more equitably and fairly. And I did not see that happen. And I still don't think to this day that I see that happening.
I think that that terminology is important in the distinctions you draw, because when we think about Rochester, frankly, when we think about New York State and the Northeast of this country, our school systems, our school public school districts remain the most segregated, among the most or the most segregated in the country. Do you have an idea in mind about what a future looks like if there's true integration, whether that's possible here?
I think that there are certainly steps that can be taken to move in that direction. I often think that a lot of what's required is for individuals to perhaps rethink what our own definitions are as it relates to being socially responsible to the communities in which we live and the communities that annex the places in which we live. But to also think about the ways in which a more equitable distribution of resources could inevitably enhance and enrich all of our lives. Being new to Rochester, I was very shocked when Tom Argost, who is a former state and city official, showed me a map of Monroe County. And looking at the way in which poverty is concentrated in Rochester City. And that's not to say that there aren't pockets of poverty in each of the surrounding counties and villages and towns that comprise those counties. But when you have it concentrated in one area, it does raise concerns. When I look at the number of public school systems that are here in Rochester, it raises questions for me about whose children are we most concerned about? Mm-hmm. And how do we all become concerned about all children? Because inevitably, these children become our future. They're our present. They're our hope for our future. And if we're not investing in them, then a question becomes, why not? Now, I think it's one thing to celebrate the exception. But if we only celebrate the exception, the one person who was identified and mentored and was given opportunities to matriculate at a top-tier school, but we're not thinking about the ways in which that should not necessarily be our focus, then the exception becomes the norm. And we continue then to perhaps dismiss and ignore, and in some cases, shift blame and responsibility back to the very children whose fault it is not that they are living in impoverished conditions.
Our community is probably like a lot of communities, especially its size, but I'm curious to know what you think about wealthier on the scale families and generally white families who, when they reach the age of having children, move out of Rochester to surrounding suburbs.
So let me say personally, I need to do disclosure before I answer that question.
Okay.
My husband and I have three adult children. And we lived in neighborhoods where our children were either the only or one of a hand few of Black children. Our children attended schools where they were either the only one or one of two or three in their advanced level courses. Our children attended both public and private schools. I was very intentional in my decision, in our decision, to send our daughter to an Episcopal girls boarding school because of my work schedule, my spouse's work schedule. So I've had some privileges that I could exercise just as my white peers who make decisions to leave particular areas. And in leaving those areas and in making those decisions, it still does not absolve any of us from a responsibility to make sure that perhaps the way in which we cast our votes will inform public policy, public decisions that have a significant impact upon the lives of people who don't have the options that we have.
And when we think about Rochester, you're obviously correct to point out the concentrated poverty. You arrived in the city right at a time when this debate about the school district was roiling, about the school board, about a proposed takeover by the state of the school board. And I'm curious to know how you view the sequence of events that leads to educational struggle. And here's what I mean by that. We have issues with graduation rates. They are improving, if slower than everyone would like, but they're not nearly as robust as everyone wants. And clearly we have issues with poverty. We have issues with extreme poverty, with children being raised in poverty. Do you see a chicken and egg situation? Do you see a school district that struggles? Do you generally blame poverty? Knowing it's complex, knowing there's a lot of layers, is poverty generally the root of that? Or in a community where there is such persistent poverty, do you think struggling schools are the root of that poverty?
I think it's a both and. And the reason I think it's a both and is that when we look at poverty, we know that there are systemic issues that lend themselves to creating those conditions. We also recognize that in some cases, there are health issues that exacerbate those conditions. I think, too, when we look at public education systems, we have to ask ourselves if public educators actually receive the support that they need, many of whom live barely at or earn barely a minimum living wage. Do they have all of the resources that are necessary? Have we thought about what the teacher-student ratio is for optimal learning? What things are in place so that parents who lack the basic ability to support their children outside of the classroom are receiving the type of support that they need? If we say that teachers are sometimes as instrumental as family systems in shaping and influencing children, then it would seem to me that a greater investment in our public educators would certainly be merited.
Talking to Dr. Angela Sims, the new president of Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School. She officially started on the job on July 1st, and she is filling the shoes. Well, no one's going to fill the shoes. Everyone's different. She's not here to necessarily do exactly the work that Dr. Marvin McMichael did, though we had many great conversations with the Reverend Dr. Marvin McMichael over the years. And now it's Dr. Angela Sims here leading Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School. And you weren't always on a track to be a minister, as I understand it. Tell me about maybe the earlier adult life and the path that ended up sending you to Crozier.
So I am second career.
Yeah.
I worked in the area of accounting, went to seminary simply because I heard a call. And I grew up Baptist. And in my family of origin, it was always understood that girls could do anything they wanted to do, but there was this unspoken thing, and that was accepting the church. And it wasn't something that I really questioned until I began to get older, began to attend services at different faith traditions. And in response to that call, my family of origins stance is that if you are called to do something, the first step is to prepare. And so for me, that meant going to seminary. I was at a church where no one had ever gone to seminary, but I knew that that was the path for me. I was very fortunate that one of my college classmates from Tulane was a Navy chaplain, and he just happened to have been assigned to Bethesda Naval Medical Center, and he mentored me through my entire three-year MDiv program at Howard School of Divinity. While at Howard, I was introduced to clinical pastoral education and spent a year doing my MDiv program at Children's National Medical Center in D.C. And then following graduation, spent a subsequent year as a CPE fellow. I also had the privilege of affiliating with a church in Prince William County, Virginia, whose pastor had gone to seminary, had an MDiv, had a DMIN, and was very affirming of women in ministry. And so I spent about 3 years shadowing him and having responsibility for training about 20 associate ministers who were affiliated with our church. But it was during that time that I really recognized I was not called to congregational ministry. That as much as I loved the people, as much as I loved congregation, what congregations do, that it was not what I was called to do. And at that moment, I knew I needed to return to school. I didn't think relocation was going to be an option. And so I looked at PhD programs in the area. I looked at DMIN programs in the area. And I actually entered a DMIN program at the School of Theology at Virginia Union. And my advisor pulled me aside and said I would not have an option in my elective courses, that I would go down the street to the Presbyterian Seminary and take PhD courses with Katie Cannon. The rest is history. That first semester, Dr. Cannon invited me to study with her. My DMIN cohort released me. I applied for the PhD program. I was accepted, had a wonderful experience, rigorous though it was. And because I trusted my advisor, I had no intention of teaching at a faith-based institution. But because I trusted her, I applied for the position that I ultimately accepted and at which I received just tremendous support and mentorship the previous 12 years. But for me, it was a journey. It was learning to listen, but also arriving at a point when I did make the transition to the academy, recognizing that I could not set aside the business experience that I had been graced to receive and to participate in. And so now thinking about the ways in which that entire journey from corporate America through seminary to an administrative faculty position in Kansas City has prepared me to serve as chief steward at Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School.
It was a unanimous recommendation to the Board of Trustees by the 17-person search committee recommending Dr. Sims be the next president. One of your first duties as president is to oversee the school's relocation. Now, for a lot of listeners who might not know the geographic debate, this is one of those parochial things where people were very passionate if you live nearby or if you have a connection to Colgate, Rochester, Crozier Divinity School. But if you don't, you know, you might think, well, what's the big deal with this? Well, it is a big deal, and especially in this community. And I know you've said that you want to be a little bit more connected. How do you think things are going there? What are some of the reactions you've heard?
So, number one, I think that we are now in our second month. We've completed 2 months there. One of the things that I most appreciate about
At Village Gate. Yeah.
One of the things I most appreciate about our 320 North Goodman Street location are the students' responses. Their joy at being on one level where the library is located. They have ease of access to administration, ease of access to their faculty. They have a community gathering space that on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, they pretty much own. Students are there on Wednesdays preparing dinner, and they invite whomever's there to join with them. The chapel and the classrooms, the fact that the chapel and classrooms look out onto the railroad tracks remains for me a symbol of what it means for a seminary to prepare its students for service to church and world. Not unlike, and one of the things I've actually had to sort of check myself on as I speak with staff and faculty is that our previous location at 1100 North South Goodman, though it was located on a hill, I want people to think about the ways in which we don't look down on others, but the ways in which perhaps being in an elevated location provides us a landscape. And the results of that landscape should influence the ways in which we approach theological education. No different than being running parallel with a railroad track, recognizing that on one side of our building is an emerging, affluent neighborhood of the arts. With being attentive to, on the one side, gentrification and urban renewal on the other side. On the other side of those tracks is Main Street, which has its own fluid demographics running along there. But thinking about the ways in which historically trains have cut off communities of color from the vibrant sectors of that city. And so I want us to be mindful that space and place do matter, and space and place must in some ways inform our curriculum, our degree programs, our curricular offerings, and our engagement with the community.
Talking to Dr. Angela Sims from Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School. And I think it's also good it'll be instructive to hear you define how you view theological education and the mission as you see it at Colgate Crozier Rochester Divinity School, because there are different schools of thought about theological education. There are some who think that that theological education, and then subsequently the church, religion writ large, ought not intermingle with politics. There are some who say it is impossible for it not to. There's this idea that social justice is either naturally intermingled with theological education, or that there's misunderstandings of the message. How do you view the mission of theological education and how it sort of interweaves outside of Colgate but in the Rochester community?
So I'm going to begin with a statement that I heard former Secretary Madeleine Albright make November 2006 at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion in Washington, D.C. And Albright said, "The one voice that was almost always missing around decision-making tables was the voice of the theologically trained or theologically educated individual." So as I survey the landscape of theological education, I think that it is at a juncture in history where it is up to presidents and deans of theological institutions to really talk about not only the distinctiveness of our own programs, but the richness and value of demonstrating the ways in which theological education is not confined and should be neither confined nor defined by quote-unquote churches or congregational life. What I find myself wrestling with these days is the way in which theological schools, seminaries, might be doing a disservice to its constituents and future constituents if our response is always in reaction to what's going on in the life of a local church. And by that I mean, if I look at predominantly white, historical, Protestant, and Catholic traditions, where exponentially the numbers that populate the pews on any given day are shrinking. And in tandem with that is a greater reliance on their own endowments if they are fortunate to have one. If we are responding to that, then it means that we have not done our job about looking at the greater and larger religious landscape, because there are other quote-unquote faith traditions that are exponentially growing, either in the U.S. or in other sectors of the world. And I think that from my perspective, messaging matters. And the messaging for us at CRCDS is beginning to shift such that we are thinking about the ways in which our existing and emerging partnerships actually are attentive to the ways in which community leaders might benefit from theological education, how business leaders might even benefit from a one-year MA or a 24-credit certificate program, because they're then able to think about the ways in which their decision-making is really intentionally and purposely informed by the values that they hold.
You're going to get business leaders to do a 24-credit or a one-year program?
So I think about a young man that was in a one-year MA program when I was in my PhD program. He was a medical school student in Richmond. He took a year sabbatical to do a one-year MA. He's now a palliative care provider. His one-year theological education has informed his approach to patient care. With business leaders, many of whom are active in their faith communities, a one-year or a 24-credit hour certificate might certainly strengthen not only their engagement with their local congregation, but with their community, and they certainly shape the way that they continue to think about the ethos of the organizations that they lead.
So I don't want to draw too many assumptions, but as your student now, tell me if I'm on the right track here. When we have a community like this where there is such seemingly intractable poverty, extreme poverty, children in poverty, to some degree, it feels like the larger picture has to include the idea that that is true because we don't want it to change. And I'm not saying that people want poverty, but I'm saying that we make values choices as a society in which we accept and largely perpetuate this. And if you're in the business community, am I on the right track that you're thinking, given the current system, given a capitalist economic system, that participation in your program might engender some change in approach that even within the strictures of a current system would lead to perhaps more egalitarianism?
I would certainly hope so, because as you point out, the economics of poverty is real. And from my perspective, what does it mean for people to be able to work themselves out of a job, right? If I am a service provider that perpetuates poverty rather than looking for ways to obliterate it, what would be required for me to work myself out of a job and creatively thinking about the ways in which I redeploy my skill set?
Can we, as a society, see the kind of significant change that is needed in communities like Rochester under capitalism?
So I don't think all capitalism is bad.
No, I'm not. Right. I don't mean to imply it. I'm asking directly only because we had very direct conversations with your predecessor on this subject, and it's a very interesting subject right now in this country.
So I do restate the question.
Under capitalism, can we dramatically reduce poverty? Can we reduce extreme poverty, extreme levels of child poverty, particularly in largely segregated communities like Rochester?
It would require systems of accountability and responsibility. It would also require a willingness to hold individuals accountable who literally benefit off of the backs of poor people. So beginning with housing codes and making sure that quality housing becomes a priority, making sure that individuals have access to quality health care, and thinking about the ways in which perhaps we need to rethink our measures of success that are often associated with capitalism, where it's not always the bottom line, particularly if that bottom line is only benefiting a very select few.
To be clear to listeners, when I bring up that capitalism question, is not meant to be loaded. And if you haven't already, you will meet some people involved in the local chapter of Conscious Capitalism who are working very hard to make change within the system that they think is very much possible. So, no, there's some very interesting discussions happening in our community. Talking to Dr. Angela Sims, the president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School since July 1st. And the next time we talk, I won't even call you the new president anymore. It's just that it's the first conversation on this program. We're thrilled to have her here. After our only break of the hour, if we could, I'd like to talk about the research and the work you've done on the subject of lynching. And how you see its echoes and even the power of some of the themes around lynching in 2019 America. Sure. So let's take that break and come back with Dr. Sims next. Coming up in our second hour, we talk to the Young People's Poet Laureate. Naomi Shihab Nye is a Palestinian-American whose latest work and collection focuses on the activism and inspirational work done by teens and young people around the world. We're going to talk to her next hour about how to get poetry, or how to get that out of our minds and embrace and feel the power of it. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guest, Dr. Angela Sims, president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozier Divinity School, is the new leader of CRCDS, following in the footsteps of Dr. Marvin McMickle, who recently retired. And it's a great honor to talk to Dr. Sims, who has this, as you're hearing this hour, this wide-ranging resume that's taken her across the country, and some of your research has looked at the history of our own country. And before we even talk about lynching, I want to ask you about a term that we hear more and more. When we talk about white supremacy, I think, and this is just sort of coming from my own background and upbringing and trying to understand how people react to it. I think for some, usually white Americans now I'm talking about, and I think about people like this, largely the school and suburban community I grew up in outside Cleveland, Ohio. Growing up, the term white supremacy basically meant KKK. It wasn't a layered, close analysis of structural racism and advantage. I think it was confined to almost cartoonish racism. And the way that term is now discussed more broadly now, I think scares some people and turns off conversations. I am not advocating we don't use the term. In fact, I think we need to. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious to know how you view the way that term gets received and what you want communities to understand about what white supremacy means beyond lynching, which we're going to talk about in a moment.
So your reference to individuals seeing it almost as cartoonish, during some of the most brutal times in U.S. history, says that in some ways that became an escape mechanism not to have to deal with the real effects of the way in which race has been constructed as a social phenomenon in this country, and the way in which a performance of race is often relegated to look at the worst in persons who are not necessarily identified as white. When we recognize the evolution of white supremacy in this country from its founding, right, as an occupied land up until now, the very persons who control language are ones who have benefited from this construction. And unfortunately, because many who also make decisions about publishing, whether it's elementary and secondary textbooks or whether it's college textbooks, often also benefit from these untalked about, unarticulated privileges. When whiteness still remains for many the plumb line for determining what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, I'm not sure why it's difficult for some of my white colleagues to have these necessary conversations. I think part of it is because individuals are unable to perhaps look at themselves personally and at the same time look at a system. And so unable to perhaps understand how, yes, you can benefit from a system and yourself, quote unquote, not necessarily be racist or prejudiced, if you, for some who want to use that language, mm-hmm. or be biased. But I think that part of it is because if the work is done to really look at the systems from which one benefits, then one then has to make some decisions. Do I divest myself of the system, or do I think about ways in which I use the system to make a difference?
I have to think it goes to education. In my own experience, barely even knowing vaguely what redlining was until I was mm-hmm. almost 30 years old, I think if schools teach that white supremacy is the KKK and it's not systemic advantage that's been perpetuated for decades and centuries, that we will have adults who will recoil when they hear white supremacy mm-hmm. as if, are you saying that I'm mm-hmm. wearing white sheets as opposed to perpetuating systems of mm-hmm. advantage? Is that fair?
I think that's fair, but I think it also points to some of my work, and that is understanding that the face of the KKK was often not the face of the architects of a system that allowed a KKK to emerge mm-hmm. as a terrorist organization in this country. And that often, because of the way in which race was constructed, I would posit that there might have been members who were doing the bidding of the KKK simply because they saw that as their entree into a greater system of privilege, without recognizing that they would never become a full-fledged member of that small group of folk who were influential.
You've done a lot of work on lynching. In 2019, to state the obvious, to the extent we've seen any lynchings, it's not the way it used to be. And I'm curious to know, first of all, if you see echoes of the fear and intimidation that lynchings engendered still today. And then we'll talk about the work and what your research, I think, tells us about our own country. But do you see those echoes today?
I do see those echoes. And for me, it's because as heinous as lynching was, the culture that lent itself to those barbaric practices was equally as heinous. So when you can create a system designed to elicit a certain behavioral response, you begin to instill fear. And it required that same use of rhetoric to invoke fear and intimidation, I still see present now. I think that for the most part, when I look at some of the language that's used, the only group of people that I don't necessarily see at risk in some regards in this country are individuals who are cisgender, heterosexual white men, or those who can pass as such. Everybody else, in some regards, is at risk.
I thought about asking you if you think the president is a white supremacist, but then I thought if that question is insulting in its obviousness.
I do think it's insulting in its obviousness, because for me, it raises the question, how then do we analyze language, recognizing that words are weighted, and that words in and of themselves inflict harm, mm-hmm. Put people at risk of being harmed, and that if that is not identified for what it is, it then suggests that the onus of responsibility for always addressing these issues continues to reside with the persons who are more likely to be harmed because of those words.
And so let's pivot that a little bit then. Why do you think there are tens of millions of Americans who not only voted for this president, but resist any such label of racism or white supremacy?
So when I look at the campaign that Mr. Trump ran, while I totally disagree with his value system, the campaign that he ran was brilliant, and it was brilliant in this regard. He simply built on what had already been unleashed during the Barack Obama administration. When you have individuals in elected office buying into birtherism, when you have the Senate majority leader saying, my objective is to make sure you are a one-term president, when you have individuals talking, using language to quote-unquote take back one's country, without individuals thinking about what that really means, when you have quote-unquote strict constitutionalists who are not allowing themselves to perhaps nuance the changes, the amendments, and what those amendments to the Constitution actually mean, when you have individuals who are promoting a narrative, a myth or a lie about individuals not being able to have a certain lifestyle because of another group of people, all Trump did was to tap in to the sentiment that was already just at the surface.
What drew you to the research of lynchings?
The year after I finished my MDiv at Howard Divinity School, I spent a year doing independent research with an ethicist, a theologian, and a Hebrew Bible scholar. And I looked at 1st and 2nd Isaiah, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King Jr., and Ida B. Wells, and was drawn to the work that Wells had done as an investigative, self-trained investigative journalist around the issue of lynching, and looked at how her own stance on lynching had evolved when the personal became political, when her goddaughter's father was a postman and a businessman was lynched. And she knew at that point that perhaps the reasons that were given to justify lynching were not necessarily accurate. So when I had an opportunity to study with Katie Geneva Cannon, I was really most interested in the way in which Ida B. Wells' three-phased approach to combat lynching in the early 19th century, to boycott, migrate, and write, might be instructive for us in a contemporary era.
And how so? Tell us more about that.
So what Wells causes me to think about is the fact that boycotting, we can really be intentional about our own economic decisions. Migrate, not everyone can relocate. Not one, everyone has the means or the opportunities to do that. So for me, it means how do we change and shift our perspective, even if geographically we can't change that. And to write, how do we empower people to speak for themselves in such a way that we recognize that the voices of what some would consider to be the least of these are often the most powerful voices that we need to hear.
And so when it comes to engendering change, when we envision what we want to see happen in society, and I'm not talking about getting everyone to vote exactly the same. I mean, diversity of thought is important, mm-hmm. And diversity of political ideas mm-hmm. is important. But I am talking about a society that is less tolerant of the suffering of sort of marginalized populations, oppressed populations, entrenched poverty, children in poverty. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the sparks that light change most consistently?
Often when it becomes personal, when one has an experience with someone and recognizing that that person should not be perhaps held responsible for his or her own condition. Touch makes a difference. And I think that in some regards, that's why public educators really can be agents of change, because they are able to hear those narratives and to hear those stories. I also think that the work of pediatricians can be extremely insightful in helping us to think about change. I think nutritionists and social workers can provide a multitude of insights to help us change. I think that clergy, who are often on the ground social change agents, provide insights that some of us may never think about. I think about the individuals who drive school buses and who are often the first to perhaps, even if they can't name it accurately, to recognize that there are issues that need to be addressed with children.
I absolutely take the point on the personal impact, or at least the personal connection. There are many obvious examples, but in the last generation, we've seen a very significant change in public opinion on equal marriage, same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. The former Vice President Dick Cheney's daughter is a lesbian, and talked. He didn't talk a whole lot publicly, but occasionally. And yet, I feel like, yes, empathy matters, but if we're relying on everyone to need personal connection, to want to eradicate structural racism, extreme poverty with children in the country, we're pretty bubbled. We're pretty good at segregating ourselves and sort of self-sorting. And if we're waiting for those personal impacts, some of us may wait a lifetime and not have it. And can we find change without having everyone who needs to change have it?
So for me, I would think that empathy would also inform policy. And educating ourselves around issues so that we become better informed when we go to the ballot box, but also encouraging people to actually understand the way in which voting is a civic responsibility, but to do so informed, not to just necessarily vote a straight party ticket, but to really think about the ways in which the policies that are proposed will make a difference. I also think that, that in addition to empathy and policy, engagement in one's community, whether it's volunteering or whether it's really thinking about the ways in which we can be more actively present in our own communities. And for me, the personal does not necessarily mean individual, but it does mean a greater awareness of our context.
In our last couple of minutes, just a note to producer Megan Mack, the governor's calling me and the phone's ringing off the hook. We've got to figure out what's going on in between hours. I don't know what's going on. What's going on, governor? Maybe the governor wants to talk to you. You're going to get to talk to everybody, I'm sure. In our last couple of minutes with Dr. Sims, I think it would be really interesting to hear you describe sort of, you've been talking about Rochester as someone who, you know, you moved here this summer. Communities sometimes get kind of down on themselves. I mean, they don't see what's great about certain communities. And I understand why. People are both defensive of where they grew up, but they're also, sometimes they get sort of in a rut with where they grew up. What to you, as someone who's new to Rochester, what do you see that surprises you that people don't love or sort of celebrate more often?
So let me tell you what I've really been surprised about here. The women leaders across industry sectors in this town are some of the most welcoming, affirming, willing to reach out, help, make connections, make introductions than any community I've ever lived in. I'm not sure how that happened, but it's a model that I would love to see replicated in every community. I guess the other thing is there's a vibrancy in this area, and I haven't been able to really name what that vibrancy is, but when I look at some of the inter-religious conversations into which I've been invited, and that's another strong component.
The interfaith community?
It is extremely strong in this area, and a great deal of mutual respect with, and what I consider a genuine interest in not only similarities, but in really understanding someone else's faith tradition. I think about the work that's going to occur tonight in I think it's the 105th celebration of Gandhi's birthday, and that's an interfaith gathering. So those two things for me have been wonderful, delightful surprises. And my prayer for myself is that I would be a genuine contributor and participation in making sure that that legacy of welcoming continues.
You are the first African-American woman to lead a college in Rochester and here in Western New York, and that is certainly a milestone. I think the challenge for any community is to make sure that those changes are not one-offs and that there is a building. And it's very interesting to hear you say that you come here and you see a vibrant female leadership, women in leadership across the region. It's a powerful statement, and I'm really pleased to spend the hour with you. I hope we can do this much more because I know you're going to be a very important figure in this community for years to come.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Sims is the president of Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School, which you'll now find in Village Gate, and you will find and hear about their mission as it grows and integrates throughout the Rochester community. Short break. More Connections is coming up.